Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Joining us on the show this week is child psychologist Dr. Stephen Whiteside talking about how to help your children deal with back-to-school anxiety. Changing schools, getting a new teacher can all play havoc with your child, and Dr. Whiteside has tips to get you through the transition. We then chat with author Diane Levin about kids and teenagers being exposed to mature content too soon in life and trying to act provocatively at a young age. Finally, we speak with Dr. Mayur Lakhani about death and dying and how important it is to be honest with both the patient and the families during this challenging time.
Capture your need for sound.
For a lot of people around the world, the summer months are coming to an end, and that means that kids are getting ready to head back to school. This can cause a lot of anxiety for some children. So to help us understand how we can help our kids through the transition is Dr. Stephen Whiteside, a child psychologist at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Whiteside, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Dr. Whiteside, can you explain some of the causes of kids getting anxious heading back into another school year?
Well, anxiety is a normal part of life. We all experience anxiety. For some kids, their trigger to experience anxiety is a little bit more sensitive, so they have more pronounced symptoms than other kids do. The reason they have that probably is some combination of genes and what we inherit, but also what we've learned over the years through our experience. And when a new situation like going back to school comes up, that's often a time when we all experience more anxiety, and those who are more prone to have problems might develop more problematic anxiety.
Now, are most kids nervous or anxious about going to school? Like, is this a thing that we all sort of go through?
I think that would probably be pretty fair to say, but of course I'm kind of nervous myself at times, so just because I experienced anxiety before school started doesn't mean that everybody does. Everyone's different, and there's a wide range of what's normal, and some people experience very little anxiety, and some have a good amount of worries, and some sleepless nights before school starts, and then all that could still be considered normal.
Now, with regards to, I guess, the anxiety, is this something that is inherently in a child, or can it be, I guess, exacerbated by their parental unit?
Both of those are true. We know, research suggests that anxiety disorders have a genetic or biological portion to them. They tend to run in families. If parents are anxious, they're more likely to have kids that are anxious. But that only accounts for some of it. And certainly the way we act as parents can influence our child's anxiety, and other experiences that kids have or adults have influence whether or not they're experiencing anxiety.
Do you think a lot of children keep their anxiety to themselves, for fear of being teased or not taken seriously?
Yes, I think, that's definitely a problem. The estimates of how frequent or how many kids have anxiety disorders differ, but it's somewhere around 10 and sometimes as high as 15% of kids meet a criteria for an anxiety disorder. However, only about 30% or so, and it depends on the disorder, go in for treatment. So that suggests that a lot of these kids are keeping it to themselves, and it's not being picked up by others around them. Disorders like behavior problems or ADHD are problems that parents and teachers often are very quick to pick up because they cause problems for other people around the child. But anxiety is something that is very internal, and although there are certainly things that parents can pick up on, sometimes they can go below the radar, and these kids are at a particular risk of not being recognized and not getting help.
What are some of the signs, I guess, that a parent would see maybe when the kid's even like 2, 3, 4? Like, I'm assuming some of this, characteristics or these characteristics are showing themselves at that young of an age.
Yeah. In younger kids, anxiety is one of the most likely forms of anxiety in younger kids is separation anxiety disorder. So kids becoming very nervous about separating from their parents. As kids get older, they may start to have more specific fears, such as animals, and then social anxiety, feeling nervous around others in the teen years, and then more generalized anxiety in young adulthood. And as you probably notice, all of those things are all very normal. It's very normal for kids to get nervous separating from their parents or for us to feel shy around other people. We call it an anxiety disorder or problematic anxiety when it's very distressing to the child or to parents as well, and or is getting in the way of them doing the things that they need to do. So So things for parents to look for are, one, is the child's nervousness, worry, anxiety, fear getting in the way of doing what needs to be done? Does it seem to be excessive? Do they seem to be more nervous and get more easily upset in situations that cause anxiety than other kids their age do? Other signs of anxiety are, for example, separation anxiety, becoming very upset, crying, having anger outbursts when it's time to separate, resisting to separate, resisting to doing things independently, complaining of stomach aches, withdrawing, crying easily can all be signs of anxiety beginning to become a problem.
Now, when you see these signs in your child, you know, how do you deal with that as a parent? Like right away, should you sort of try to deal with it on your own, like by reading books or maybe understanding that this is, you know, maybe something even you went through as a child? Or should you very quickly sort of head off to see a professional?
Well, I think you definitely should try to handle it on your own because, for one, again, anxiety is a normal part of life, and so anxiety is more like blood pressure as opposed to a broken leg. A leg is either broken or it's not, whereas blood pressure is kind of along a continuum, and once it starts to creep up over a certain level, we call it problematic. Anxiety is the same. We all have anxiety. It can cause us all of us problems now and again, and it's just when it's crept up that it's caused frequent problems, that's when we call it a disorder. So the first thing for parents to think about is that they need to be warm and supportive. It's upsetting and it's difficult for kids to feel scared and worried, and having parents react with frustration or anger or ignoring the symptoms that they're having can make things worse for kids. So the first thing is to be warm, supportive, and encouraging of your child. The second thing to think about is, again, anxiety is normal and tends to often come and go on its own. So just try to keep things normal. Don't overreact. Be supportive of your child and see if things gradually get better. One of the things that tends to keep anxiety going is avoidance. So if we're nervous about some situation and we avoid it, we're probably going to we're more likely to continue to be nervous, and that anxiety might even grow. So if I'm afraid of dogs and I stay away from dogs and never go up to dogs, I'm never going to learn that dogs are usually okay. We're talking about family pet dogs here, and my anxiety will continue or maybe increase. As long as parents are being warm and supportive, they can help their child by having them make sure they don't avoid. So gradually approach what they're afraid of. Practice taking small steps to face their fears. So if they're afraid of dogs, that might be going to a friend's house that has a dog and with help from the parent going over and petting it and gradually becoming more used to spending time with the dog. If it's separation, it's gradually separating. Maybe spending some time playing in a room by themselves with the parent going in and checking on them as they're playing well on their own. If it's social anxiety, it's practice maybe making a phone call to call a friend to come over or going up and talking to kids at the playground.
If we break things down for a second with regards to, I guess, a child's education, can you maybe explain some of the anxiety they might go through? Let's say, you know, if the child is like 4 or 5 and is heading off to pre-K or grade 1, and then, you know, I'm assuming there's different anxieties as you go through elementary school, and then for sure, because I remember them getting, you know, being quite anxious going into high school.
So school presents different challenges for all of us as we develop. Initially going off to pre-K or maybe even daycare before that, probably the biggest worry is going to be separation. Some kids may have had some experience with that before, again, through daycare, but many kids, this will be the first time that they're leaving home and spending a regular, consistent amount of time away from their parents, and that can be very frightening. So that's probably the main concern early on. As kids tend to get older, social anxiety can be more of the primary concern, worrying about being liked by other kids, how are things going to go socially, am I going to make mistakes that make me stand out and people laugh at me, are people going to tease me, and that it can be particularly a concern in middle school when pretty much everyone is self-conscious, and kids with anxiety even more so. Transitions from elementary school to middle school, from middle school to high school can be particularly hard. The transition, oftentimes when kids start middle school, they begin to move from class to class, and that includes a lot more responsibility on the child's part, having to keep track of books and papers from different classes, that can be stressful. That those times between classes are an unstructured time when there aren't isn't as much adult supervision, and that can be stressful and cause anxiety in kids. So those are probably, and then you know, once they get into high school, the demands for your grades start to count for college. There's a high level or higher level of school expecting you to be independent and start to think about what am I going to do after school. School sports start to become a little bit more high profile and more pressure there, and so there's a lot more pressure to be successful and to do well. And also as kids start to develop and have other interests in terms of relationships, in terms of other type of activities that are more adult oriented, some kids develop faster than others, and there can be a lot of anxiety and worry about how are we going to handle different situations that come up socially, and how to stay true to your values but also fit in with everybody else can be a huge source of stress for some kids.
Joining us on the show is child psychologist Dr. Stephen Whiteside. Dr. Whiteside, with, you know, understanding, I guess, the anxiety that kids go through at the different stages of school and sort of life as you head off into adulthood, if a child is sort of properly handled, I guess, to just use that word, you know, when they're quite young, have you in your research experienced that they then handle anxiety better as they go through school and into life because they sort of have been taught, maybe whether it's by their parents or professionals, sort of how to handle anxiety, and they're just more confident in themselves as they go through each step of life?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one, unfortunately, that we don't have a really good answer for. Those type of studies are very challenging to do, to be able to take a group of people, of kids, and treat them and then see how they've done. Many years later, it's hard to follow up with people. It's also hard to have one group that's been treated and one group that's not treated, so we can't answer that question definitively. But that's the hope, that by helping people learn strategies to manage their anxiety, one, they'll be better able to manage them when they have anxiety in the future, and two, if anxiety can be less of a problem throughout childhood, it's less likely that they're going to have develop other problems such as depression or school difficulties, which are going to make life harder in the future. There have been some studies on the effectiveness of therapy for child anxiety, and one study looked at kids as far as 7 years out and found those kids to be doing well. So there is some evidence suggesting that if this is treated well early on, then these kids can enjoy the benefits of that for many years later.
Do you think teachers and school guidance counselors can help make the situation, you know, better for kids if they themselves are properly trained?
Certainly. Identification of kids' mental health problems frequently can occur in the school. The schools have a lot of caring, trained professionals who see kids, not only see kids for a great portion of their day, but also see lots of kids, so have a good sense of when a child is starting to drift out of that normal range and may need some assistance. So schools can be very helpful for identifying kids in need of help, but also everyone and most people today are busier than they need to be or busier than they would like to be. And so it's hard to have to, especially when you're dealing with kids, because if you're going to a doctor's appointment or a therapist appointment, you have to have not only the child, but at least one parent go. And so if some of these treatments can be done in school, where rather than a 30-minute drive to an hour appointment and 30 minutes back, you can just pull the child out for half an hour, 45 minutes, as long as it doesn't interrupt their schooling too much, can be a much more efficient way of getting help to these kids.
And Dr. Whiteside, just to sort of wrap things up, what would, I guess, be your biggest piece of advice to parents or guardians, you know, who have young children that are about to go through, you know, all of these steps of going to daycare and pre-K and stuff, you know, to get themselves as well as their kids ready for this?
So I think the first is to be warm and patient, that it can be very stressful. As a parent, it's very stressful when our kids go off to new things and do new things. Even if they're standard going to school, it's a big deal for parents. If we are visibly upset and visibly anxious and having trouble dealing with something, our kids are going to pick up on that. So taking care of ourselves and making sure that we can be strong and confident. It's one, when you're stressed yourself, it's harder to be warm and patient. So making sure you take that extra moment, take a deep breath, take care of yourself so that you can be warm and patient for your child. Patience also comes in not overreacting when things go hard the first time and realizing there's a good chance that things will gradually on their own get better. Getting information, not only for yourself, but for your child can often be helpful for new situations. So if you can go tour the school, if you can take your child to the school, if you've got an opportunity to meet the teachers or other kids that are going to be in their class, all those types of experiences that are basically small steps that help you prepare for going off to school can be very helpful. Even things as simple as changing your routine. So if your child is usually getting up 9 in the morning and they're going to have to get up earlier for school, having them get up earlier that week before rather than just the day of or day before so that they start getting into that routine can be helpful. Making sure that anxiety doesn't start making the child avoid things. So having the child gradually do the things that they need to do and not avoid, and not being afraid to get help if things seem to be getting out of control. Going and talking to a primary care provider or family doctor is a great place to start, and they can provide reassurance or referral to more specialty treatment if the anxiety is warranted.
Dr. Whiteside, thank you so much for all of your help. I really think this is going to help parents, you know, help get their kids ready to go.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's child psychologist Dr. Stephen Whiteside. For more information, very simple, just Google Whiteside Mayo Anxiety.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
In this day and age, with all the gadgets and imagery right in their faces, it's no wonder that kids are trying to act older than they are, especially when it comes to their sexual expression. TV shows, music, video games are all laden with sexual imagery, and kids are getting exposed to this material at a very young age, and they are definitely not ready to handle the responsibilities that come with it. To help guide us in understanding and dealing with our children and handling this material and what it means in their lives is Diane Levin, co-author of So Sexy, So Soon, and a professor at Wheelock College in Boston. Diane, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, Diane, in your opinion, how young are kids picking up on sexual imagery and having it sort of, you know, seep into their brains?
Well, it depends what you mean by sexual imagery, because it means different things to children at different ages. So with young kids, we're talking about preschoolers. It's already having a big effect. It's where they're thinking about how I'm supposed to look. And they know they're supposed to wear clothes we would call sexy for four-year-olds, but they may not. Sexy for them doesn't mean the same thing.
Okay. And so I guess, you know, what do you think about when they see, you know, like if we go back a bit, I guess, and look at some of the pop stars that have been out there in the last couple of years, like if a four-year-old, you know, is dancing to Lady Gaga or,
exactly,
you know, stuff like that, how are they perceiving these costumes that she would wear and maybe, you know, some of the, you know, because I have nieces and I've heard them sing some songs and mm-hmm. it's hard to hear them talking about a disco mm-hmm. stick when you know that the disco stick is not what they think.
Right, exactly. So in part, children think differently than we do, so they make different meanings, but gradually their thinking evolves and it becomes more and more related to sexual issues. And in the time I've been working on this subject, which is 7 or 8 years, it's gotten more and more younger and younger. So when you think of something like some of the pop stars that are out there and the female pop stars and the kinds of clothes they wear, the kinds of songs they sing, it keeps getting more and more extreme to capture the attention of kids as they get kind of desensitized by the time they're 8 or 9 to what's out there. You need to get more extreme to capture their attention again. So I've seen a steady escalation of what we're talking about. And when you think of 3 and 4 year olds, what it is, well, I'm supposed to move that way, and when I do it, my friends like me. And that, in fact, for many children becomes more and more the criteria for their social relationships and who likes them and who doesn't. They use it to judge themselves and others.
And is it hard if we just sort of stick with these pop females for a second?
Yes.
Just, you know, and again, I'm a radio announcer and I love a lot of these artists and I think a lot of them have a lot mm-hmm. to say and so on. But I do think some of them get very much caught up in their image. And is it detrimental for a child, let's say, who is maybe a little bit older, even like, you know, 10, 11, 12, something like that, where they would be following a teenage pop star, and I'll just use Miley Cyrus as an example,
right,
you know, where she was quite, you know, all American girl. And now 2 years
down the line, she is like sexy vamp. Does this really sort of change and negatively affect these young kids who all of a sudden are like, wow, she was, you know, sort of sweet and cute and looked like me, and now she looks like Lady Gaga?
Right. And in fact, they think, okay, well, she was younger, and when I get older, then I'm supposed to do what she's doing too. They don't have the cognitive skills that we do to think logically, to abstract and look at the implications, et cetera. They focus on how things look, and that becomes their model. So with someone like Miley Cyrus, you know, you start with 4- and 5-year-olds who, you know, the 10- and 11-year-olds you're talking about now were 4 and 5 when she started becoming big and when they started getting interested in her, and they've watched her evolve, so then they think, well, then that's how I'm supposed to evolve. And so it becomes this, they're looking for role models. We know kids' role models now are more and more coming from popular culture rather than the doctors and the policemen and the other kinds of images that children used to have. And pop stars are a really important role model. And someone like Miley is a perfect example of what I said before, where she keeps escalating the ante to stay at the head of the curve. And when she's the number one role model for little girls when they're 5, to kind of then when they're 10 to be doing things like this, to me, not only is it harmful to kids, but it's incredibly unethical to exploit children this way. And take advantage of their vulnerabilities.
Now, because, you know, I'll use this term, I guess, just sex as a blanket term, because sort of sex and all things related to it, you know, seem to be pretty much everywhere these days in the media and at school, at what age should parents make sure they're dealing with it and maybe starting to explain things? Because I know you said yourself it starts very, very young.
Right, and it's not just talking about sex. When I started writing the book So Sexy So Soon, it was a big process of figuring out, well, I've written about violence before that, and violence, everyone agrees violence is bad, and we want to figure, we can tell kids, you know, you need to find other ways to solve your problems besides hurting each other. We're not going to say to kids sex is bad, so what is it that's wrong is what I kept asking myself. What's wrong is when kids are young, they should learn how to have caring, connected relationships with friends, with family members, so as they grow up, that when they grow up, they can have caring, connected relationships where sex is a part. What's happening now is for little girls, the sexual stuff that's happening when they're very young, so much of it is focusing on appearance. Buy this to look this way and then act this way because the star who wears this kind of clothes acts like that. But it's an objectification. They judge themselves by how they look. They judge others by how they look. And so that, and boys judge girls that way, and so it really is undermining girls' ability to kind of be human, have human caring relationships, and keeps them objectified. And I think that's so important because you end up, that happens way before you start talking about sex. So when we're upset about things that little kids are doing, it's not sex, it's sexualization. It's focusing on appearance. So when kids start asking questions, we should be able to answer them. The single biggest strategy I try to help parents with is think about how to stay connected with their children around these issues so they experience what a caring, connected relationship is as an antidote to all the objectification of relationships they're getting from the screen.
Now, do you think it's important for parents, let's say, to set down some rules where, you know, the 8-year-old is not putting on makeup, you know, that, you know, it's fun, or, you know, they might have the little makeup kit when they're 5, but they're not going to graduate to actual makeup by the time they're 8, that, you know, you don't need it till you're 12.
They shouldn't have the makeup kit when they're 5 if we can avoid it. What I try to help parents do is think about how to protect their children as long as possible. So therefore, you know, use screens very cautiously, choose the content very carefully, think about how one's dressing our children, you know, our daughters, and thinking about what kinds of toys they have that help them develop a whole range of skills so they're not focusing on appearance more and more in their play. And so as they get to be 8 or 9, you know, it's like, say it's 6, a little girl says, but everybody else has this makeup. Or if a kindergarten teacher, a teacher of 5-year-olds told me last year, a little girl went into the bathroom with other girls and showed them her bikini underwear set with a bra. And all the girls went home and started nagging with their parents that they wanted them. That just saying no, yes, I would think parents should say no, but I think just saying no will not solve the problem. Parents need to connect with the kids. Well, how come you want it? And really, and here's what I think about it. I hear you really want it, but it's really for someone who's older. So little girls feel like they're not going to just sneak around and do things and have a completely different world that they're involved with that their parents just say is bad. And so they stay away from their parents. We need to figure out ways, even if we don't always end up doing exactly what we want, working things out with our kids so they're learning as they go along other ways of thinking about what's going on, but they're feeling safe talking to us about it. Because what's happening more and more is, I mean, a parent told me last the end of last school year when their daughter was going to a dance, one of her first dances, she was in eighth grade or seventh grade, and there was all that she wanted to get a really sexy dress, and there was this whole discussion with the family, with the daughter about why the parents didn't want it, and there was this whole battle, and they really negotiated to come up with something that wasn't totally what the parents wanted, but also not totally what the daughter wanted. That's very different, so that the daughter went off to the dance fairly happy, and the parents felt relieved. That's connecting, versus another family who had a similar issue said, absolutely not, you can't do it, you have a dress, and that's the one, and the daughter said, I don't want to wear that one, and she had to wear it, and the father went to pick her up at the dance early, and she was wearing one of her friend's dresses. We don't want kids sneaking around like that at age 10 and 11 and 12. We want that. I mean, it was, used to be normal for adolescents to start getting into some of that behavior, but not when they were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
And do you think, I wanted your opinion on this, do you think that, let's say parents are parents of a boy, let's just say there is no girl in that, you know, family mm-hmm. unit, or there's two boys or three boys, mm-hmm. how important is it for those families to deal with their sons? Because I feel like a lot of families that have boys think that they don't have to deal with any of this.
That's a great question, because a lot of people think that. And So Sexy So Soon is about girls and boys, because boys are getting all kinds of messages about how they're supposed to be, too. They're taught they have to be tough and macho and ready to fight, and this is a lot of my earlier work. You know, that for them, the images, the toys, the things being marketed are kind of starting from very young, are weapons and violence and increasing violence. So boys are taught that being tough and macho and ready to fight is how they be popular and how they judge each other. And the boys who are bullied, and as bullying goes up in school, as kids have more and more of this objectification, so they're meaner and meaner to each other and don't know how to, their empathy is delayed. Their ability to empathize is really getting undermined. We have boys who learn to look at girls as objects. We have already at age 5 a boy crying because the Cinderella playing princess doesn't want him to be the prince. There's all kinds of ways boys and girls need to learn how to interact with each other in humane and thoughtful ways that are getting undermined by these huge gender divisions where girls have to be pretty and sweet and boys have to be tough and macho, and boys need to attract at pretty and sweet gradually becomes prettier and prettier and then sexier and sexier, and somehow boys view that as the model they need to kind of connect to. So in So Sexy So Soon, there's a letter that a mother shared with me that her son in third grade brought home from a little girl that said, I know I'm not as pretty as so-and-so. I know I don't have as fancy clothes and I'm not as sexy, but I'm really a good person and I really love you and I want you to be my boyfriend.
Wow.
And that's now happening with younger and younger children. That was 5 years ago. And I hear stories, versions of that story with younger kids. So boys and girls ultimately need to learn how to have relationships with each other that are respectful, caring, and there are many forces at work helping it, making it harder for boys to do it and girls to do it, as well as affecting their relationships with each other. And the other piece of that is all the what's going on simultaneously is the total objectification of sex, when I said earlier kids aren't thinking about sex, but by age 9, 10, 11, a huge proportion of boys in the United States have seen pornography on the internet at this point. And adults aren't dealing with it, but it's also giving them all kinds of lessons about objectified sexual behavior, not relationship sexual behavior.
And do you also think, Diane, because this is something I would wonder, or I've thought about just in my own experience when I was mm-hmm. in school and stuff. My brother, for example, he has grown up with two older sisters and a very strong mother. So I find that he respects women very well. Like, he's very caring to his wife and he's very caring to his two daughters. And I'm just wondering, you know, when it comes to boys and families, like, how important is it for family units to make sure the boy is respectful of women so that even if he is with his friends, he doesn't get caught up, you know, in treating them badly?
Right. Well, I can tell you, I raised just one child, and it was a son, and it was in the midst of all of this sexualization kind of coming to the fore. It was very much a part of his childhood. It's much worse now than when he was young. And to me, it's not being just respectful to girls is not as the overriding issue is learning how to be respectful, how to be heard, how to listen to others, how to respond. Kids are not born being able to do that. It happens through experience and interacting. As they spend 4 to 6 hours a day glued to screens, they're not having that one-to-one feedback with each other. They're not learning how to interact with one another. So I would say, yes, having friendships with girls, trying to be in situations where the gender divisions, which can exist so extremely in culture today, where boys and girls learn how to connect to each other is great, but underlying that is learning how to be respectful of everyone.
Joining us on the show is Diane Levin, again, co-author of So Sexy, So Soon. You can learn more at sosexysosoon.com. Diane, when it comes to, you know, we sort of touched on it earlier, dealing with pop stars or television shows, should parents be sitting down with their kids and really understanding what they're watching, especially even, you know, let's say a certain household doesn't let their children, you know, watch A, B, or C, but they're talking to friends at school and know what's going on anyway.
Exactly, and that's why I say delay it as long as possible. But I think when kids start seeing it at other houses and know they can't see it at their house, it's a time to really think about what's going on and how can you connect with kids with all the content they're getting at other houses. And often that does mean watching it yourself as the parent to understand what your child's seeing so you can talk better about it. But sometimes it may be, well, you know, we've said we weren't going to watch it, but I know you've seen it, so let's watch it together so we can talk about it because I'm really interested in what you think about it too. So connecting with kids, again, it's another example of connecting. So again, it's not, you don't just say, well, my child's going to see that show some point, so I'll watch it now and watch it with my child. You wait, you try to delay it as long as you can, and then when it seems relevant, you watch it. When some parents, you know, with the same thing happens with movies or with toys linked to movies, you know, violent toys for boys and sexualized toys for girls and highly sexualized dolls. When kids start being exposed to a lot of that stuff, you may say, well, we're not going to use it here, but tell me about what you do with it when you're over there. I'm really interested. And, oh, so you do this. Well, what would happen if you did that? And so you're clearly interested and you're not saying it has to be my way.
I'm wondering in all of your research if this has come up, because this is something that has played an important part in my life, and I'm just wondering if it's like a thing, you know? Athletics. I've always been very much into athletics, and I think because of that, it gave me more confidence, you know, in who I was as a person. And so I feel it was easier for me to get through sort of middle school and high school because, you know, I had this sport thing to do, and I just felt better about myself. Mm-hmm. Do you think if more females and males were maybe involved in sports, and they had a better sense of self, that some of this wouldn't rub off?
That's one place where it can happen, but they're very different kinds of sports, and some of them just build more objectification and more competition and more mean-spirited behavior, and other sports can be very positive. So sports is one of many possible things to engage kids in. I always think helping kids find things they're really interested in and helping them become good at it, and I don't mean having 10 hours of classes a week necessarily. You know, my son loved Play-Doh. I'm not sure why, but I started making him Play-Doh, and he used it all the time. And when he got to school, he asked if he could take a clay class after school when he was in fourth grade. So we said, sure. And he started doing wonderful things with clay based on his own prior experiences. And when he was in high school and could take an art class, he took ceramics. And he's very good at it. But it was kind of nurturing what he really felt good about. Again, when kids feel good about themselves, that's often just, I mean, that's one of the things that comes from sports. For girls, sports is one place they can do it, but feeling competent about many other things could be just as valuable, I think.
Fantastic. And I also wanted to ask you, you know, because I think a lot of parents, you know, are unprepared to deal with this stuff. I know my parents were unprepared to have certain conversations with me. They got through it, but it was difficult, and I'm assuming that's the same thing for many people. So what do you tell parents, you know, especially because, Diane, like you mentioned, things are happening so much quicker.
Right.
How do they get through this?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we connect with our kids around it. There's some very good books out that can be read to fairly young children, like by the time they're 4, 5, or 6. And you don't just say, okay, now we're going to do it. You kind of wait and see, well, it seems like this might be a relevant time because all kinds of issues are coming up. But often the kids make a real distinction between the sexualization they're seeing and then when there's a family friend having a baby or a parent, you know, or their mother's having a baby. And then they get interested in a different way and they often don't see there's a connection between the two. So it varies a great deal in age when it's going to be appropriate. When it seems relevant, on the SoSexySoSoon.com website, there's a list of children's books and books as kids get older for dealing with these issues that we recommend quite highly.
And to get your book, is that the best place to go as well, Diane?
SoSexySoSoon.com? Well, I would certainly say for dealing with these issues, yes, because we don't give a Band-Aid. We say there's not one size fits all. We try to give parents strategies for understanding the issue and ways to work on it to build on what's happening in their family. It's not like do these three things and the solution is over, I mean, is solved. But, I mean, the problem is solved, and that's what we tried to do in the book is really give parents resources so that they could, and so that every parent experience is going to be different in how they use the book, and we think that's great.
Fantastic. Diane, thank you so much for your time today. It's been amazing.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Diane Levin, co-author of So Sexy, So Soon. For a copy of her book and more information, check out her website, SoSexySoSoon.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
The topic of death and dying is not an easy subject to discuss, but because it is a part of life and something each and every one of us is going to experience, it is an important issue to address. To explain the importance of having this conversation is Dr. Mayur Lakhani, a practicing general practitioner in England and chair of the National Council for Palliative Care and the Dying Matters Coalition. Dr. Lakhani, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much, Kelly. I'm very pleased to be on your show.
Now, in your work and experience, Dr. Lakhani, why is the subject of death and dying so difficult to discuss with not only the patient, I'm assuming, but also with family members as well?
Yeah, I think there is a great reluctance to talk about death and dying. I think there's two things. Some people feel that it will tempt fate and that if they talk about it somehow that it will happen earlier than it would happen naturally. Now, we know that that's not true. But quite often people feel that it's not going to happen to them. You know, our research shows that even very old people in their late 70s and 80s sometimes feel that death is a long way off. So I think it's this idea that death is something that's going to be far away, it's not going to happen to us, or that if we have a serious illness, well, that's when we can start thinking about difficult things. But of course, we know from experience, both as a doctor and as a member of the public, that if it's left too late, then you don't have a chance to say goodbye and prepare for your final weeks of life. So we think it's really important to start thinking about it early, to start preparing for it, both as a doctor, but also for members of the public.
Now, doctors have to go through so much training to be certified medically. Do they also have to go through courses to deal with the social aspect of their jobs, like dealing with death?
Yes. So as a family doctor, family physician, I have to go through some training to, for example, to learn how to break bad news. You know, it's really tough as a practicing doctor, telling somebody that their life is coming to an end. is not an easy thing to do, even though I've done it many, many times and you've been trained for it. So quite often, although doctors have had training, both physicians, internists, and GPs, they sometimes lack confidence. And what we find is that doctors use euphemisms instead of being direct with patients. So they might say to someone, your mother is seriously ill. But what they actually mean is, your mother is dying, and she could die during this admission or during this heart attack or stroke. Because something that I hear time and again from members of families is, I wish the doctors had told us that my mother or my father was dying. Because if you know that your loved one is dying, then you can say goodbye, you can say, you know, I love you, you can say sorry, and it puts you in control. But if you don't know that they're dying, and because, you know, naturally people, if somebody goes into intensive care unit, you think, well, that's there for people to get better and my loved one will come out alive. But of course, that may not happen.
Now, doctor, I wanted to ask you this as well, because you are a doctor and you have just told us that you've had to give this news, you know, on several occasions during your career. Do you ever find with yourself or maybe even with some of your colleagues, because I think some of us in the regular population would wonder this, do you ever get sort of on automatic pilot when you have to give this news? Because I feel bad for doctors who have to give this information, because I'm sure it's obviously an awful part of your job. And I'm wondering if some coping mechanisms creep in where you sort of disassociate yourself from the situation.
Well, that would be a wrong attitude or reaction to develop. I mean, we do have rules and methods that have been taught to us, for example, in breaking bad news. So there is, a method that we follow. But, you know, Kelly, in all my experience, and I've been a doctor for nearly 30 years now, every situation is different. Every family is different. And the empathy and sensitivity, you know, this has got to be done with such great sensitivity. It's incredibly important that. So I know families where they do not want to know very much. Now, if you have not ascertained that to begin with, and then you carry on telling them stuff or asking them stuff that they don't want to know, then you'll get that very badly wrong. You know, that'll be a scarring experience for them and for the doctor. So the first step always is, how much do you know? Why do you think we're having this meeting? Or how did you feel when you were told you had cancer? Now, I think everybody reacts to it in different ways. Therefore, you have to be, we call it mindful. You have to be mindful when you're with the family so you don't get into autopilot and, you know, just give the standard answers. So in summary, I think, you know, there is a method. So you have to go through that method for it to be successful. So some people might say, well, you know, these are stock answers you're giving. But in my experience, you have to be sensitive to each family's particular needs.
Now, how detrimental is it when a doctor gives false hope?
Okay, so I think it's very detrimental. And I feel very strongly about that. Let me give you one example, Kelly. When somebody is very ill, for example, they've got multiple conditions or cancer that has spread, there isn't, despite the best endeavors of doctors, there isn't much more active treatment that can be given. There's an important decision we have to make around what's called CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So if that patient were to have a heart attack or their heart were to stop beating, what should the doctors do? Now, I have seen some doctors offer that as a choice to the patient and the family. So something like, if your heart were to stop, would you like us to start and do CPR? Now, that is a false choice and a false hope, because it's a clinical decision, because research has shown that in circumstances like that, the chances of survival or recovery are so small as to be discounted and actually could leave somebody very damaged or have more painful and undignified treatment. So what should happen in that case is the doctor shouldn't give false hope, because the choice, the hope of CPR is that you'd bring somebody back to life when we know that that will not happen. is to actually explain that this is a clinical decision. Do they know what CPR is? Explain the recommendation that it would be much better for your mother or your father to have a naturally dignified death because they were a dignified person, and to jump up and down on their chest and to put tubes in their throat and do operations when they're 80 or 90, when the chances of survival are very low. And their methods for deciding it, Kelly. So I'm talking about someone that really, for whom there's no active treatment possible. And despite our best endeavors, the chances of recovery are extremely small, that I think it's important not to offer false hope.
Joining us on the show is Dr. Mayur Lakhani, a practicing general practitioner in England and chair of the National Council for Palliative Care and the Dying Matters Coalition. For more information, dyingmatters.org. What do you suggest for doctors to do to get more comfortable and proactive about discussing these issues with their patients or family members?
Okay, so I think first thing is to be more honest with patients. Be sensitive, discuss situations carefully, but be direct. So I think avoid euphemisms. So even things like, you know, we use euphemisms in everyday life, you know, somebody passed away. Or for children, we say they've gone to sleep. But in fact, what we should say is somebody's died. Or if a doctor is concerned about a patient's condition, they should use direct phrases like, despite our best endeavors, there's a risk that you're loved one could die, and that allows families to prepare. So I think getting training in end-of-life care conversations, and we know that doctors find it difficult, although they've had some training, sometimes it's a question of confidence. So some booster training in communication skills, which is what we've done in our project in England with family doctors, even a short amount of training, like an afternoon's training, really builds up confidence. So get comfortable in talking about death and dying. And our second message to physicians is do it early. You know, when somebody's unconscious, they're in the last few hours of life, they can't make decisions. But if you do it when, we say usually at the time of diagnosis, or if there's a deterioration or somebody's getting worse, sit down with the family and give them a chance. You know, would you like to know more? Classic example is dementia. If somebody's got advancing dementia or a diagnosis of dementia, it's best to have conversations before they lose capacity to make the decision. So, and we use a 12-month time frame. So when somebody is well, they make the decisions, it puts them in control. They can sort their will out. They can sort their personal affairs out. They can see the people they want to see. And they can decide things like, I'd like to be cared for at home, which is usually what people say. I don't want to be tube fed, or I would like this treatment. And, you know, we go through like a list of things to discuss. So for doctors, I think for all doctors, especially frontline doctors, you know, surgeons, physicians, emergency room physicians and family doctors, especially family doctors, I think, because they know their patients. We say, be confident in communication skills and have the discussions early.
What types of discussions need to be had, I guess, about palliative care? Because, you know, not all of us are just going to, I guess, drop dead of a heart attack or a stroke. Like, some of us are going to be in hospital or whatever for months.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So that's a very good point, Kelly, because in fact, most people die of heart disease or lung disease or of old age. We call that organ failure. Classically, dementia, old age, general weakness where organs in your body fail. So this is not cancer. Most people, thankfully, with cancer get better. So sort of discussions to have, and I think a practical thing would be if you're faced with a major diagnosis, so this is when would you have discussions or when would you want to talk to somebody if you've been diagnosed with a major condition, or if you're age 55 or over, or at a major point in your life, you feel, I want to have these things sorted, then I think have a discussion. The discussion should involve things like, what kind of care do I want or do I not want? So some people come to me and say, look, If I'm involved in a serious accident and I've got severe brain injury, I do not want to be in intensive care for months and months. Do what you can, but I'm quite happy for the doctors to make the clinical decisions. But usually the two big decisions, areas of decisions, are place of care. So a lot of people say to me, look, don't put me in hospital. They can't do any more for me. Care for me in home. Please arrange for nurses, volunteers, other doctors. Care for me at home because I want to be in home, in my own bed, surrounded by friends and family. So we spend a lot of time discussing place of care. And then we discuss types of treatments that somebody may or may not want. And there are other things like spiritual matters. And then we always recommend that practical things should be sorted out, like make a will. For example, in our research, we found that only a third of the people had made a will. Only a quarter of people had talked about death or dying. And sometimes this was with married couples, people who had been married for many, many years, but they did not know. One couple I'm thinking of particularly, they did not know whether they wanted a burial or a cremation. And these are obviously very practical things. So we say to people, just like we did a initiative thing, plan your own funeral, you know, to get people talking about it and to be more comfortable. So there's practical things like put your affairs in order, clinical issues, and then the place of care.
Do you find most people, Dr. Lakhani, are unprepared for the cost of palliative care and even just dealing with it in general?
Yes, I think there's a lack of knowledge and there's uncertainty. A lot of people get scared. So, for example, I referred a lady to a hospice about a couple of years ago, and she was very frightened. She said, I don't want to go there because that's where you go to die. And in fact, when we'd explained the whole service and when they'd visited the service, etc., she had particular needs that she couldn't be cared for at home. It was a real eye-opener, and they felt so comfortable with the environment. So I think we all need to do more to raise awareness of death and dying and of palliative care in general, which is why we set up this movement. Because, you know, death is inevitable. It'll happen to all of us. Our research shows that only a third of people have really given it any serious thought. And, you know, the sense of relief when you see a family where this has been done early and it's been done well, the relief is so palpable because, you know, Kelly, I think sometimes people are more ready for these discussions than their doctors. The doctors are feeling a bit anxious and, oh, I don't want to upset the patient, you know. But actually patients and their relatives, they know that their loved one hasn't been right. Repeated hospital admissions, spending most of the time in bed or in the chair. Mobility reducing, feeding difficulties. And we're talking about an aging population, which is a worldwide phenomenon that I think dignity and talking and planning for end of life, which is a more modern phrase now. So in England, we use end of life care as a preferred term for palliative care. So palliative care is more around the symptom relief and comfort. And because I think the best reason for doing this is puts you in charge. It puts you in control. It puts you, the patient, when you're reasonably well and you have capacity to tell people around you what kind of ending you would like.
What would be, I guess, your main message to doctors as well as to, I guess, all of us about planning for and dealing with your end of life? Because, again, like you said just a few moments ago, it is inevitable.
Yeah, I think for doctors, I would say become confident in discussing end-of-life care issues and do not shirk your duties or the conversations you need to have. And my second message for doctors is please plan early and think of the patient in front of you and consider, could they be dying? Then I would say for the general public and their own behavior, when it comes to things like, have you made a will? We found that doctors were just as likely not to have made a will than members of the general public. So I would say practically for for members of the general public, I would say, do whatever you can do. Small actions make a big difference. You know, register as an organ donor. Write a will. Let those close to you, let them know soon how you'd like to be cared for, what kind of funeral you would like, what your wishes are. So practical things are very important. And then I would say, ask your doctors questions. Don't be afraid. Talk to them about prognosis, which is around what can I expect from this condition. And if you've got relatives, particularly in nursing homes or care homes, frail older people who are deteriorating, then that will be a very good opportunity to talk with their doctors around future choices for care.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Kelly.
That's Dr. Mayur Lakhani, again, a practicing general practitioner in England and chair of the National Council for Palliative Care and the Dying Matters Coalition. Again, for more information, www.dyingmatters.org.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Thank you for joining us on the show this week, and a big thank you going out to my guests, Dr. Stephen Whiteside, Diane Levin, and Dr. Mayur Lakhani. I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Henry David Thoreau. Do not lose hold of your dreams or aspirations, for if you do, you may still exist, but you have ceased to live. So that does it for us this week. Have a great week, and please make sure to keep checking our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com, for new blog posts, as well as our Twitter and Facebook pages for messages.